Take you now to the NBC newsroom.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is H.B. Kaltenbrunn speaking to you from the NBC newsroom. Here is what has happened. President Roosevelt phoned Secretary Early half an hour ago that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, the United States naval base on Oahu Island in the Hawaiian Islands. A few minutes later, he again phoned Mr. Early and told him that planes had attacked Manila. This means that war is underway between Japan and the United States. President Roosevelt's announcement of Japanese air attacks on United States Pacific bases staggered London, according to a dispatch just received. And London now awaits Prime Minister Churchill's promise to declare war on Japan within the hour. This has come to you from the NBC newsroom.
This ensuing program will be interrupted at any point to bring you any further bulletins on this all-important Far Eastern situation. Keep tuned to this station. Wake up, America! The American Economic Foundation, through the courtesy of NBC and the independent stations associated with the Blue Network, presents the Wake Up America Radio Forum. In the American tradition of freedom of speech, the Foundation acts as host, without prejudice or favor, to speakers of all shades of political and economic thought. Today brings a debate on the subject, can there be a substantial reduction in non-defense expenditures of the federal government? The speakers are Dr. Henry M. Wriston, president of Brown University, and the Honorable T.V. Smith, former congressman at large from Illinois. The Foundation, having no opinions on controversial issues, the opinions expressed by the speakers are, quite naturally, their own. In this, as in all Wake Up America discussions, after the speakers have briefly stated their position, the balance of the first 30 minutes will be devoted to handling questions of the speaker's own choosing. During the last half hour, questions will be accepted from the studio audience and from today's telephone city, Denver, Colorado. Denver is the gateway to the magnificent playground of the Rocky Mountain region. It has the largest park system in America, the highest automobile road in the world, almost 3 miles above sea level. But Denver is also concerned with the business of defense. In addition to being the largest sheep market in the world, headquarters for Colorado's gigantic beet sugar industry, and one of the world's leading production centers for mining machinery, Denver is the site of Lowry Field of the United States Army Corps Technical School, the $35 million Denver Ordnance Plant, and a 64,000-acre bombing range. Denver is also a financial, cultural, and educational center. Its famous Rocky Mountain Radio Council, in which 28 colleges, universities, and other educational institutions participate, has performed outstanding service in making radio a vital and useful educational medium. The American Economic Foundation warmly welcomes the questions from this great and progressive city. If you live in or around Denver and wish to question the experts, phone your questions to the Voice of Denver, station KVOD of the NBC Blue Network. The telephone number is Maine 3191. Maine 3191. Your question must be phoned in during the next 25 minutes. Now, quite obviously, it is impossible to extend this opportunity to all the stations on the network. Today, station KVOD, Denver, Colorado, is the only station that can accept telephone questions. All questions not answered over the air will be personally answered by mail. The discussion will be under the direction of our moderator, Mr. Fred G. Clark. Mr. Clark, will you take over?
Thank you, Mr. Engel. Can there be a substantial reduction in non-defense expenditures of the federal government? To discuss this question, Wake Up America brings you Dr. Henry M. Wriston, president of Brown University, and the Honorable T.V. Smith, former congressman at large from Illinois. Each will briefly state his position, and we will proceed immediately to the questions and answers. To ensure fair play to the speakers and to enable them to answer as many questions as possible, we have here a brilliant white light, which goes on when any answer or rebuttal lasts longer than 60 seconds. The person speaking is then allowed 10 seconds additional to conclude his remarks. If during the hour, either of the speakers makes statements with which you wish to challenge, please feel free to write them. Care of Wake Up America, you will receive a personal reply by mail. That concludes the preliminaries. We will first hear from Dr. Henry M. Wriston. Dr. Wriston, if you please.
During the current year, over half of all government expenditures, federal, state, and local, will be for non-defense activities. Such a rate of expenditure cannot continue indefinitely. Indeed, the Secretary of the Treasury has said, I quote, "We simply cannot carry on business as usual and government as usual from now on and still take adequate care of our defense needs," end of the quotation. Consequently, saving is one of the first duties of the federal government. Depression devices should be eliminated and non-defense spending cut. So far, no real beginning has been made. Though the farmers' income has more than doubled since 1934, direct subsidies to farmers have tripled in the same period. And there is no assurance that subsidies will not be increased yet more. Expenditures in aid of the unemployed have grown even while unemployment was shrinking. The whole youth situation has changed since the NYA and the CCC were set up. Yet their appropriations became hardy perennials, growing in inverse ratio to the emergency. Although public works are one of the important ways to counteract depression, now with the war boom in progress, the Rivers and Harbors Bill bids fair to be the greatest in history. It includes major projects which compete with the defense effort. $1 or $2 billion saved out of the huge federal expenditures may not seem substantial, but it is an evidence of good faith that the government does not ask needless sacrifices, that there is a will to economy, that big figures have not made government careless of any restraints, that urgency and haste are not being made an excuse for thoughtless waste. It is a symbol of the care which is vital to confidence that victory abroad does not involve defeat at home.
Thank you, Dr. Riston. We will now hear from the Honorable T.V. Smith. Mr. Smith, if you please.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Ladies and gentlemen, we all believe, I think, with Thomas Jefferson, that government is best which governs least. But that belief itself settles few concrete issues, for how little is that least in which we believe? It's certainly bigger in war than in peacetime, and it's certainly bigger in present peace than in past peace, if this be peace. So it is with governmental expenditures. We agree, I suppose, upon the least expenditures consistent with statesmanlike national purpose. But how big is that least non-defense expenditure? That it ought to be less now for peacetime purposes may be taken for granted. So it is already, as a matter of fact, decreasing. But how rapid is the decline of non-defense expenditures, and how rapidly ought it to be declining? That's the question that we're debating. I think Dr. Riston and I are agreed upon the principle. We will always disagree somewhat upon the when and where, upon the how and how much of governmental policy. I submit, therefore, a principle to regulate this disagreement on practice. It is the principle of the Roosevelt administration from its beginning. It is this: government should spend more and tax less when times are hard, spend less and tax more when times are good. That's the principle. Is it being applied now to non-defense expenditures? Yes, it is, but not fast enough to please Dr. Riston and many other people. I submit, however, that impetuosity in applying even a good principle can do a great deal of harm. We cannot cut off farm aid completely or relief aid all at once without forfeiting more than we need to forfeit. Nor should we abolish the machinery of NYA or CCC, if that's what Dr. Riston means by substantial reduction, for we may need these agencies again. What we can ask is a constant decrease of non-defense expenditures during war preparation. Pressure for this end is, I admit, very desirable to overcome certain political lethargy. But we are nationally acting in the right direction now as touching this matter. And to me, that is the all-important thing. Taxes themselves are a test of intention against great odds. And the administration has shown and is showing courage in the infliction of growingly heavy taxes as prosperity itself returns.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. We're now ready for the questions which the speakers have addressed to each other.
Bring up the white light here. Stop light.
The first question is from Mr. Smith to Dr. Wriston. Is it more for defense or just less for government that you seek?
This can be answered in a single word. Both. More for defense we are certain to have. And I do not see why government, which lays the burden of priorities on everyone else, should not accept the burden of priorities upon itself. I do not know whether it is a just estimate or just a scare story when we are told that between 2 and 3 million people will be thrown out of work under priorities unemployment. But it is clear that the defense juggernaut will run over many small businesses. I should like to suggest that we have heard nothing about any priorities unemployment in government bureaus. At the end of March 1940, there were nearly 1 million civilians, 949,000 to be specific, on the federal payroll. In March 1941, there were 1,200,000. On September 31, the number had grown to 1.5 million, and an additional 50,000 were coming each month. Instead of transferring them from non-essential bureaus to essential defense activities, more and more are brought in. They set up competing bureaus which steal employees from each other, demoralizing those bureaus already in existence. We know, it is admitted on all sides, that the inevitable characteristic of war is that there must be a reduction in the standard of living for the public. But I am insisting that there can be no justification for not having a similar reduction in the standard of living in the non-defense bureaucracy of our government.
Mr. Smith, have you a comment?
I think I'll make my comment as the questions move on.
All right.
You, please.
The next question is from Dr. Wriston to Mr. Smith. Is this a suitable time for the largest rivers and harbors bill in history?
No, clearly not. If you regard the rivers and harbors bill purely as a pork barrel appropriation, which many people do. But may I make two observations. One of them is that proposals for river and harbors appropriations are not appropriations for rivers and harbors. Many things happen in Congress between the cup and the lip as elsewhere. And second, that both rivers and harbors, and especially harbors, may in time of war become defense expenditures rather than port expenditures.
Any comment, Dr. Wriston?
Well, this particular Rivers and Harbors bill is the biggest in history. It has 230 projects. It requires 40% higher appropriations than the last Rivers and Harbors bill of 1935. And the two biggest of these appropriations were put within this bill substantially by the pressure of the administration. That is the St. Lawrence Waterway and the Florida Ship Canal. I'm not going to argue the merits of either of those projects. Of course, when presented in any other form, they have been consistently defeated. But from the standpoint of principle, this is a bad time to engage in activities which compete with defense efforts. Manpower needed for defense plants will be released if this kind of bill is not passed. But we must remember that this Rivers and Harbors bill has in its largest item the support of the administration.
Any further comment, Mr. Smith?
Well, I may remark that the St. Lawrence Waterway, for instance, is certainly not divorced from the matter of defense, from electric water power, and the very people who talked about the appropriations for TVA as being both a waste of national money and a prostitution of national principle are now joining in deploring that we do not have more electric power because we do not have more dams at the TVA. These things must all be taken in perspective by thoughtful men. And I think the example in which Dr. Wriston has seized is an extraordinarily bad example to lop off as pork appropriation.
Any further comments, Dr. Wriston?
Well, on that, my only comment would be that inasmuch as this power cannot be brought in for 4 years, it represents an extraordinarily pessimistic view with regard to the length of this war. Furthermore, it means that during this time, Canada also must make substantial expenditures. Its exchange is already a somewhat difficult problem, and this will make that exchange even more difficult. We will be competing in this for a long period with defense effort. It'll take manpower, it'll take money, it'll take machinery, it will take all of those things. Whereas this is the perfect picture of the kind of a project that Mr. Smith spoke about, of spending more in times of depression. This, however, is a time of boom, and unless it can be brought in much more rapidly than the engineers have indicated, it seems too bad to bring it up now.
All right, the next question is from Mr. Smith to Dr. Wriston. Do you propose to abolish any agencies, discontinue any functions, or merely reduce the non-defense load of expenditure?
I would answer with an enthusiastic yes. I would certainly abolish a great many agencies. The NYA and the CCC should be absorbed into the Office of Education, with which they're now competing. The 12 different housing authorities, who are competing avidly with each other and have created such chaos that the president has had to bring in a special investigator to find his way around through the mess and make recommendations, these should be absorbed into a less number of agencies. And wherever, as in the Department of Agriculture, there are agencies paralleling and duplicating each other, I would certainly discontinue them. Some of the government corporations, by which the government itself seeks to escape from the governmental process, by which Congress's control of the purse is defeated, by which adequate financial reports to the public are made impossible, and by which the public debt is increased by invisible methods, should certainly be abolished. Orderly housekeeping in the governmental structure, observance of the obligations and public interests which are laid on private corporations, and a decent respect for the substance of the democratic process would abolish a huge number of competing offices. And I call your attention to the fact that the indictment of overlapping, confusion, and waste comes not from irresponsible people, not from carping critics, not from people who want to use the emergency, but from people within the administration.
Mr. Smith, do you have any comments?
There are a great many people who look, for instance, at education from the outside who think that we have an enormous amount of overlapping educational effort. I imagine that Dr. Wriston would not be very happy if it were proposed to abolish Brown University because it's close to Yale University and Harvard University and let them carry on its function. Nor would I be happy either because the function itself is the important thing to begin with, and not the agencies that carry it out. Now, you notice that he very carefully refrains from saying that any of the functions of government, such as done by the CCC or the NYA, should be abolished. If he believes they should, let him say so. But if he believes they should not, but that the agencies that do them should be consolidated with other agencies, then I may call attention to that is to the fact that that's the question of expert judgment as to whether it could be done best by different agencies, somewhat overlapping, or by one agency. And certainly, the notion of abolishing the offices without abolishing the function is the source of the discontent, really, of the effort to decreasing governmental expenditure.
Further comment?
Yes, I'd comment on that.
Dr. Wriston?
For example, this is a question for experts. The Educational Policies Commission of the National Education Association and the American Association of School Administrators would certainly be such a body of experts. They have recently said that the CCC and the NYA are moving toward a, and I quote now, a permanent federal system of education controlled from Washington, paralleling the public school systems and competing with them for funds, staff, and students. That's the end of that quotation. The Secretary of the Treasury has recently said that the regular activities of the Civilian Conservation Corps and the National Youth Administration I quote him, must conflict with a more important defense program. That's the end of the quotation there. The Commissioner of Education of the United States, who might well be regarded as an expert in this, says that these parallel and compete with his agency in this effort.
Further comment?
I'll reserve comment for the next question, sir.
The next question is from Dr. Riston to Mr. Smith. Are there not larger implications in saving beyond current economies?
Yes, of course they are, both pro and con. It is the larger implications of the problem of saving in non-defense expenditures that we ought to be debating, and mostly are debating. So long as no one proposes to abolish the functions non-defense, which government is now doing, the proposal is not worth anything at all. If he proposes to conserve the functions and abolish the agencies, then he's doomed to exactly the same sort of disappointment that consolidation of government agencies always yields. Because the pressure to consolidate them is always done by those who wish to see the functions abolished, and the actual doing of the job is done by those who cannot abolish the functions. And as long as the functions must be preserved, ordinarily the business of trifling with this agency or the other is misexpended energy, especially if it's an agency that's done as satisfactory work as the CCC. I think, therefore, that the larger implication of the whole question of saving is, are we in favor of returning to a laissez-faire state in which we do as little as possible, or are we in favor of the service state in modern life in which most of these functions must be kept up, whatever agencies may do them?
Any comment, Dr. Riston?
I'll reserve my comment on laissez-faire because Mr. Smith has a specific question on that. But I would like to call attention to the fact that in saying specifically that I should like to halt some of these functions, I have distinguished precedent. I will quote from a very high authority. If we do not halt this steady process of building commissions and regulatory bodies and special legislation like huge pyramids over every one of the simple constitutional provisions, we shall soon be spending many billions of dollars more. That's the end of the quotation. And the author is Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Campaign talk, as Mr. Wilkie said about his own proposal.
It would be a desperate thing if we should have to believe in that, because that was not a campaign talk. That was before Mr. Roosevelt was nominated for the presidency on the 2nd of March, 1930.
He's changed his opinion since he had the responsibility of doing the job, however.
He changed it, however, not, as you said in your statement of principles, from the beginning, because the Roosevelt administration has not followed from the beginning the principle of spend more and tax less when times are hard. As a matter of simple historical fact, he was elected and his first administration was launched on precisely the contrary principle, the principle of economy in government during hard times in order to justify lower taxes and not pass our troubles on to our children. Salaries were cut, including, for example, the pension of the Supreme Court Justice Holmes. Lewis Douglas, as director of the budget, set out to make striking economies. Mr. Roosevelt, in other words, took a very strong position at that time.
All right, the next question is from Mr. Smith to Dr. Riston. How far does your insistence involve a return to normal laissez-faire after the emergency?
Well, laissez-faire, as I understand it, refers to a very brief period in history when political forces were not employed to dominate economic forces. A brief interlude between the mercantilist state, when everything was regulated into bankruptcy, and the modern developments of the social service state, the fascist state, and the communist state, which all seek to subject economic forces to political control, abandoning Jefferson's maxim, quoted by Mr. Smith, that the government is best which governs least. The word normal, therefore, seems to me wholly inappropriate, for normally political power has not been willing to let economic forces operate with anything like freedom. For myself, I would be willing to go along with President Roosevelt while he was resisting, and again I quote him, the tendency to encourage concentration of power at the top of the government structure, alien to our system and more akin to a dictatorship or the central committee of a communist regime. The end of the quotation. I agree with President Roosevelt that, quote, if we do not halt this steady process of building commissions, we shall spend many billion dollars more.
Any comment, Mr. Smith?
only fair to remark that President Roosevelt changed that conception, even about salary reductions, within the first year of his administration, when actually he was up against the facts that ought to determine the judgments of all resilient minds, as certainly it has determined his when he saw the facts changing before his eyes.
Do you want to comment on that?
If you have a comment.
I should like to. Because Mr. Smith said that we all agreed with the Jeffersonian principle that the least government is the best, and now the resilient mind has abandoned that principle, what is the essential distinction between the two points of view of this administration, the one which existed before and the one which he says now as a result of resilience it has bounced back to?
Well, it's only the matter of interpreting words like least. Those are the most slippery words in all man's vocabulary, and men will interpret them in terms of the light of the facts themselves which they face. And that's all that's happened, not only to Mr. Roosevelt, but to Mr. Landon, and to Mr. Wilkie, and to Mr. Taft, and to every other man who aspires to public responsibility in the situation which we have been facing.
I think it goes very much farther than that. It was not a return to laissez-faire that Mr. Roosevelt was then proposing. He was proposing a return to regulation to prevent abuse instead of advancing toward what amounts to management. Now, no thing had happened so far as responsibility is concerned.
Okay, and to Mr. Taft, and to every other man who has thought...
Mr. Roosevelt was then proposing. He was proposing a return to regulation to prevent abuse instead of advancing toward what amounts to management. Now, no thing that happened so far as responsibility is concerned could have changed the governor of our greatest commonwealth on that broad philosophy of government. That is a change of philosophy, not a mere intellectual resilience. And it is that substitution of political manipulation for governmental restraint which has characterized the political drift in America, as well as in Germany and Italy and Russia, and which has given us the so-called social service state, which is regulatory to clear through to the point of management.
All right, the next question. Our time is getting brief here. First half hour. This is from Dr. Risen to Mr. Smith. Is there any justifiable reason for not decreasing duplication of federal agencies in accordance with the recommendations of the Director of the Budget?
No, there's no justifiable reason for not decreasing duplication in that sense that you're wasting money. But the question is, when are you wasting money? And begging the question doesn't really help about governmental problems. I have before me the comment of one of the adverse critics of this administration entitled Waste in Non-Defense Spending, a long cock and bull story about how CCC is wasting money when it ought to withdraw. And it culminates by saying that CCC is expensive. It will cost this fiscal year some $176 million. And then, after the impression has all been made, follows at the end of the column, actually, the administrators of CCC have of their own initiative reduced its scope. They have reduced the camps from a peak of 2,652 to less than 1,000 at present. And although they had an appropriation of $247 million this year, they voluntarily refrained from spending that much. That is a magnificent tribute of an administration that's moving as rapidly as it can in the direction point.
Sorry, gentlemen, our first half hour is gone. Before turning to the studio questions and those from the telephone from Denver, Colorado, we pause briefly for station identification.
From the NBC newsroom in New York, President Roosevelt announced this afternoon that Japanese airplanes had attacked American defense bases at Hawaii and Manila in the Philippines. And the chief executive has ordered the Army and Navy to carry out undisclosed orders prepared for the defense of the United States. From Honolulu itself, we learn that at least two Japanese bombers appeared over Honolulu at about 7:35 a.m. Honolulu time and dropped bombs. Unverified reports say that a foreign warship appeared off Pearl Harbor, the naval base at Hawaii, and began firing at the defenses of that port. The sound of cannon fire is being heard in Honolulu, and NBC's own reporter on the island says that one bomb dropped close to the offices of the Honolulu Advertiser in the heart of the island capital. The sound of cannonading is coming from the direction of Pearl Harbor. Just a few moments ago, the State Department issued a statement that the attack on Hawaii is still going on. And the White House says that an Army transport carrying lumber had been torpedoed about 1,300 miles west of San Francisco. This places Japanese naval action well east of Hawaii toward the American mainland. In anticipation of this emergency, the National Broadcasting Company stationed trained radio reporters in all strategic positions in the Far East. Keep tuned to your NBC station for their report, direct from the scene. This news came to you from the NBC newsroom in New York.
Before turning to the studio and telephone questions, Dr. Wriston would like to comment upon the answer just given by Mr. Smith.
I can only say that Mr. Smith is in disagreement with the administration of the country, because the Secretary of the Treasury and the President have both expressed themselves as not satisfied with these cuts. He speaks of the Civilian Conservation Corps. The Secretary of the Treasury says their appropriation is $247 million. They're spending over $200 million. The National Youth Administration, with an appropriation of about $150 million, is spending $149 million. And the Secretary of the Treasury has laid before the Byrd Committee specific ways in which $2 billion can be saved by the very processes that I have been suggesting, but that Mr. Smith is resisting.
Well, the only way in which to find the golden mean of this is after all of our sayings have been exhausted, far or contrary to the government, is to have Congress itself, which will actually happen, act upon this. And I do not doubt that the reduction of expenditures is in the direction indicated by both of us. Not as fast as Dr. Wriston wishes, perhaps not as fast as I wish, but carefully and conservatively, not to destroy what has been built.
Any further comments? All right. Is there a question from the studio?
Not yet.
If not, here's a question from Fred Davis of Denver, Colorado, to Dr. Wriston. Today, we have over 200 more boards than 1932. Could we make a large saving by cutting them out?
Yes, indeed. We can make a very heavy saving by cutting them out. Take, for example, these 12 agencies on housing. There is the District of Columbia Alley Dwelling Authority, for example, as a separate agency with a separate appropriation. There are any number of other, the United States Housing Authority, the Homeowners Loan Corporation, the Federal Housing Administration, the Resettlement Administration, Workman's Garden Homestead, Public Building Administration, all engaged in the civilian business of building buildings. And in testimony before the Senate, no one defended that setup. And yet it goes on conservatively, without any resiliency of mind, just piling up more and more complications.
Mr. Smith, comment?
And yet it would be a rash student of government and society, indeed, who would say that each of these has not arisen in terms of a need and a function that must be discharged. And I repeat, it's mostly kidding ourselves to talk of consolidating or abolishing agencies when we aren't, as a matter of fact, going to abolish the function. I'm not opposed to it, but I'm opposed to kidding myself that I'm doing one thing when I'm doing another.
Well, on that, I can only comment, but again, he finds himself at variance with the United States Housing Administrator, Mr. Strauss, who in testimony before the Senate Committee on this said these words, I quote him, "The facts are plain to all today. The tragic cost to the public interest will take years to compute. Such action was pernicious and costly in government, just as it would have been in business."
Well, may I say that I didn't come here to defend the government or any of its agencies on the one side, and on the other side, every time Dr. Wriston quotes this, he's answering himself with reference to the tendencies of the government of the United States, concretely, as I am answering for it, in terms of general principle.
That would be true if the government were pursuing a coherent and consistent policy. But we've had a great deal of criticism of competition in private business in the last 8 years. And I am here criticizing competition in public business. And there is a perfectly good reason for not having monopoly in private business, but there is an equally good reason for having a monopoly in public business. And to quote one authority showing that the government is wasting money
is not admitting for a moment that the government is saving that money.
Are there questions from the floor?
Mr. Enoch Curtin of the studio audience has a question directed to Mr. Smith.
Mr. Curtin?
Why can't the administration appoint a planning board to make a survey of the overall situation and report on unnecessary expenditures?
Well, these investigations of this sort are going on and have gone on. And the National Resources Board itself, or committee, is itself carrying on continuously and cumulatively an inventory of American life, its possibilities, its needs, its necessities. But the point is, if we kid ourselves at a time in which the services of government are expanding the world over, not necessarily for totalitarianism, that by doing this little thing or that, we are going to stop the trend of modern life in the assumption of heavier responsibilities by government, we aren't fooling anybody except ourselves.
May I respond to that?
Dr. Risson?
That is simply the argument from a trend, and the trend never reverses itself. But what Mr. Smith overlooked is that we've been through all this before. In the 18th century, they regulated everything. And as I said, they regulated it to bankruptcy, including the state.
We interrupt this program to take you to the NBC newsroom.
From the NBC newsroom in New York, Honolulu. A naval engagement is in progress off Honolulu with at least one black enemy aircraft carrier in action against Pearl Harbor defenses. This bulletin from the NBC newsroom in New York.
Back to our programs now.
For 20 or 30 or 40 years, that there will never be a reversal is simply to deny the experience of all history, which has seen one cycle after another in this fashion of big government come and then pass away.
The only difference between us there is a matter of how rapid these trends should be accelerated. I'm in favor myself of a golden mean and of gradualism in making these changes from one to the other. Dr. Riston is, too, as a matter of fact. But he's on the outside, not carrying responsibility about it, so he accelerates the criticism. And that serves a useful role. I cannot but take the point of view of the congressman who wrestled with the problems and the demands in the light of the needs and say, as long as we move in that direction, we should encourage rather than too much discourage the efforts of honest public service.
Well, my response to that, of course, is that we are not moving in the direction of reducing those. Recently, the Democratic, and a very able officer, I must say he is, the Democratic finance officer of Rhode Island, Mr. Christopher Del Sesto, says that the government is forcing the state by the leverage of government grants to increase their budget and to minimize the agencies and the activities that they would like to support. Recently, the high officer of the state of Connecticut, also this same party, made the same criticism, namely that centralization was going on, that federalization was increasing, that the pressure upon the state was steadily growing. Therefore, I don't see that there has been any reversal in this or that we're moving at all in the direction in which I suggested.
Is there another question from the floor?
Yes, Mr. Clark, Miss Ruth Anderson of our studio audience and a graduate of the University of Denver has a question she'd like to ask Dr. Risson.
Anderson?
Has not the pharmacy...
Just a little louder, please.
Has not the farmer's position improved the extent of greatly decreasing or even eliminating subsidies without causing undue hardship?
Yes. The farmer's income has increased from a net of $3,250,000,000 in 1932 up to $8.5 billion in this year. And the Department of Agriculture, in an official bulletin, says that it will increase next year to approximately $13 billion in cash. And the Secretary of the Treasury, commenting upon this, said recently that after having reached this goal, there does not appear to be any reason to continue spending at the same rate. And yet the last farm bill was the largest of all in its subsidies. Though the farmer's income was rising, it was a definitely inflationary bill at the same time that we were being warned of the dangers of inflation. And it is high time that there was a modest but resilient reduction in those expenditures.
May I say, Mr. Clark, it's over against this jerky type of criticism about this and that. Congress has had a principle to regulate its expenditures for agriculture from the beginning, the principle of parity. Whether you like it or not, the Congress has never insisted yet on achieving even parity as defined, but 85% of parity or something of the sort. And when the farmer's income goes beyond that, you will see then the pressures against the farmer becoming effective, because then you can found the adverse criticism directly upon a principle that government itself must rely upon.
I think it can be shown historically that by the time the last bill was passed, parity had substantially been reached. It was already well above 85. And at the present time, we're above parity. Does that mean, Mr. Smith, that we won't spend that $1,200,000,000 that we've appropriated?
It means that we can't allow every person to figure parity according to his own private prejudices, but we must keep to the same figures of definition of parity.
I'm taking the Secretary of the Treasury's figure.
Secretary of the Treasury has been consistently a critic of the agricultural program. Pick the figures of the Secretary of Agriculture.
There's another question from the floor.
Mr. Clark, Mr. Sipper of the Bronx, New York, has a question that he'd like to ask Dr. Risk.
Mr. Sipper?
Is not the NYA training hundreds of young men for jobs in defense industry and work centers where they do defense production work while learning?
Indeed, yes. And so are many other agencies. But the point is that there is no need for them all to be working to get the same people. And when it becomes necessary for the Federal Security Administrator to issue a definite prohibition on the efforts that were being made to enroll people in the NYA because of its competition with other agencies that were already training those people, it's time to reduce its expenditure and its activity.
Any further comment?
May I say about that general point that the criticism Dr. Riston has earlier quoted against the NYA, every one, so far as I detected, came from an interested source in defense of a competitive aspect of education, rightly or wrongly. And I repeat, I'm not in favor of the I'm not opposed to the consolidation of agencies, nor to the cutting down of any misappropriated funds or misexpended funds. But until you're willing to give up the discharge of functions, you better not hope too much from the consolidation of agencies that discharge these functions.
Can we have another question from the floor?
Mr. Clark, Miss Nellie Shannon of Washington has a question that she'd like to address to Dr. Risk. Many of the housing agencies were set up as a result of a need during the last depression. Would it not be just as economical to continue them as they are than to abolish or consolidate them now and have to go through the machinations of setting up new ones following this present war?
I'm glad to give an answer to that. The United States government, before the defense emergency came, had spent $10 billion on housing activities, half in direct subsidy and half in loans. At that time, there were only about 7 agencies competing one with another. But when the defense effort came, the number was increased to 12. And that confusion leads to competition among those agencies. It leads to driving up their own prices. It leads to such utter chaos and confusion that it doesn't seem possible to go on. For example, the Federal Works Agency now has things so worked out that there are some projects where the land is acquired by the Department of Justice, the construction is done by the local housing authority, the supervision is done by the United States Housing Authority, the management is in the hands of the Division of Defense Housing through field offices competing with the United States Housing Authority. That's some testimony before Congress. And there's no question that we ought to streamline that outfit somewhat.
Any comment, Mr. Smith?
I think unquestionably there's a point to practically all that Dr. Riston is saying, but he's overdoing the point completely. People who look at universities from the outside think not only they're competing wastefully with each other, but every department is competing with every other department in doing the same job. In one sense, yes. But for the most part, that's not wasteful competition. And if you think that engineering the social setup of a housing bomb, such as has been engineered, is not a complicated job, you ought to try it. And if you think that with the defense needs, the government is not cutting down on its activities for building houses, try to get a loan for a house above $6,000. Or try to get a loan for a house of $6,000 or less.
But if I can give one answer to that, I'm building a house and was besought by them to take a loan this summer.
This summer is not the day that Pearl Harbor is being attacked either in the rapidly moving kaleidoscope.
Nor has the attack on Pearl Harbor yet affected government policy on housing loans.
Give us until tomorrow and you'll begin to see a change of public opinion in the light of changing situations. And we'll do the job.
Now, Mr. Smith, Mr. Jacob Van Eck, Dean of the University of Colorado, asks you this question. Is there a general agreement on what constitutes non-defense spending?
I pay my deference to our friend in Denver, Colorado today and thank him for the question. As I tried to say in the beginning, unless you're making a purely partisan attack, the use of the word non-defense is itself a question-begging epithet with relation to harbors, for instance. There's hardly a thing that the federal government is now doing that in the situation that confronts us tomorrow is not going to be an organic aspect of defense activity. That doesn't mean that we may not have to cut down on some of it. We will cut down on some of it. But it's a matter, again, of more or less and of careful, cautious gradualism instead of hysteria because we don't like something. Let's get rid of it all at once.
Any comments, Dr. Richardson?
Well, I only comment I can make is that calling for economies that are supported by the President and by the Secretary of the Treasury, impetuous and hysterical, doesn't seem to me a constructive argument. The President himself has dealt with this when he said that the argument will be made that anyone who wants to dig a sandbar out of the Chesapeake so he can get his oyster boat over it will be labeled defense. Now, of course, you have to have some perspective in this whole thing, but I'm taking a position not at all in advance of important officers of the government, and it is as far as possible from a partisan viewpoint. I have no more defense for gambling in the grain market in the Hoover administration than I have for continuing to keep a great surplus of wheat and cotton now, while farm prices are affected by inflation.
Any comment, Mr. Smith?
Yes. I think that I'm not attacking the President or the Secretary of the Treasury. I was attacking the line of argument of my present friend and opponent, Dr. Riston, with reference, say, to the CCC and to the NYA. He does not, I believe, oppose to abolish these new aspects of governmental service in education or in relief. But he thinks that by consolidating these agencies, one with the other, with the functions going on, that he's doing something constructive. The history of our efforts at that are dramatic appeal. But if he thinks that we can abolish these agencies of government and the functions with them, then I think that the difference between us with reference to the democratic state is too profound really to be settled short of a learned book from Dr. Riston and one from me.
Well, I couldn't write a learned book. I'll yield that to you. But it's...
From the NBC newsroom.
From Washington, Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson today ordered the entire Army into uniform, executive effective tomorrow. His order applied to every one of the Army's 1,600,000, including the thousands of officers and men on duty in administrative posts in the War Department building who heretofore have been permitted to wear civilian clothes. In Norfolk, Virginia, Colonel Charles B. Borland, Norfolk Director of Public Safety, ordered the arrest of all Japanese nationals in the strategic naval center of Norfolk today as soon as he learned of the Japanese attack on the United States Pacific base. Washington again. The White House announced at 3:35 p.m., that's Eastern Standard Time, that the Army had just received word that an American vessel, believed to be a cargo ship, had been sending out signals of distress approximately 700 miles west of San Francisco. Whether it had been torpedoed was not immediately learned. Long Beach, California. Rear Admiral Charles A. Blakely of the 11th Naval District today issued orders shortly after announcement of the Japanese air attacks in the Pacific, requesting all officers and men attached to the district or vessels of the district to report to their stations or ships immediately. The district embraces Southern California from San Luis Obispo south to the Mexican border and all of Arizona and New Mexico. For the latest news on the Pacific situation, keep tuned to this station.
We return you now to our regularly scheduled program.
Why can't the entire agricultural program pertaining to crop control and subsidy be eliminated during the emergency?
That's too large an issue to settle in an offhand comment. I think a great many things can be eliminated, but I wouldn't want to take the responsibility for saying that they could all be eliminated, because that would require an analysis beyond that that's possible in this broadcast.
I'm so glad to see my colleague coming now to sweep reasonableness at the end, as I hoped he would at the beginning. We can't out-talk our information about these things. Surely Dr. Riston and I both agree that the soil conservation program should not be stopped or intermitted, even now. With reference to the others, we ask only that the tendency be in the right direction, both with reference to non-defense and with reference to defense.
I, of course, however, would be glad to see us return to persuading the farmer to do what it is in his own interest to do instead of paying him to do it. For many years, the Department of Agriculture showed him that it was to his interest to plant red clover. But they got tired of these people who didn't learn fast enough, so they pay him to plant red clover. I'd suspend that for the emergency.
That's a soil conservation device, if ever there was one, I should say.
All right, here's a question from O. Hensley of Denver for Mr. T.V. Smith. If it is possible and necessary for industry to discontinue business as usual, what prevents government from discontinuing pre-defense standards for spending?
Pre-defense standards, yes. We are agreed upon the fact that these themselves ought to be decreased. But it's an utter misconception of government, such as Dr. Riston gave in his first sentence this afternoon when he said during the current year over half of all governmental expenditures will be for non-defense activities. Well, over half of governmental expenditures at any time are for the normal, indispensable services of government itself. And the notion that you could come in and decrease very rapidly the expenditure of the agencies under government that have grown up through public need and public necessity is given the lie every time that any party promises and comes into power, because it finds that the great overhead of normal activities of government must go on. They're enzymatic, but we will not permit them to be stopped or intermitted.
I'd like to comment on that. That is sheer defeatism. That means that you can never repeal an appropriation. It's precisely the argument that the president was protesting against the other day when he signed the Rhodes Bill. And he said that there ought to be review and reassessment of these appropriations which tend to be institutionalized. He says he has a moral obligation to put in the budget the things which Congress authorizes. Now, of course, through the years, the presidents have been very free in making suggestions for authorization. And the moment has come to bring reform at that point and to make recommendations for reducing those authorizations and for discontinuing the renewed appropriation for functions that have been discharged. It can't be said that if an appropriation is once made, that the government achieves nothing and must forever going on doing the same thing.
Of course it can't be said. But it need not be called defeatism when it's a belief in the dynamic function of government itself, which all modern men insist upon, any more than it can be called defeatism to say that school people from the public schools to the university in an expanding area of education, the number involved and the degree to which they're carrying education have got larger and larger support from the public, both tax and private agencies. That's not defeatism. That is the definite meaning of a dynamic government in an expanding age.
But a dynamic government in an expanding age must accept an obligation to show efficiency comparable to that of the production line, to make savings comparable to those with which industry has turned byproducts into wealth, by taking waste and saving, to exhibit ingenuity like that which has wrought miracles in our laboratories, and merely to say that the thing has been done and therefore it can't be stopped is no argument at all.
From the NBC newsroom in New York.
London Prime Minister Churchill and John G. Winant, United States Ambassador to Britain, are conferring tonight. They met a short time after President Roosevelt's announcement that Japanese planes had attacked Hawaii and the Philippines. The British government previously had served notice that it would declare war on Japan within an hour of any such declaration by the United States. But there has been no declaration of war as yet. The Secretary of War has just announced that all military personnel on active duty is to appear Monday in uniform. For the latest news on the Pacific situation, keep tuned to this station.
Back to our regular program.
Moral provincialism I cannot approve, but I don't want to be put in position of defending the expenditure there either, because I don't know what its necessity is. Only after all, that is one of our responsibilities. And I'm in favor of balancing our responsibilities with all of our cares on some degree of justice, rather than the fact that it lies outside of our mainland. As note what we've done in the Philippines and Hawaii, from which, let us hope, we shall now proceed to get returns.
Any comment, Mr. Riston, Dr. Riston?
I can't comment on that, except to say that the hotel which was built there and has stood empty does seem like a non-defense expenditure that might have been eliminated at the source. And I myself haven't heard of any great public demand for it.
That was private business, wasn't it?
No, that was done under one of these government corporations, which, by the way, didn't make any report to the government for over 2 years after its organization. It was organized in the state of Delaware.
Gentlemen, I'm sorry, but our time is up. Let's conclude this discussion. Remember, it is not too late to send in your question. It'll be placed with the other questions not handled over the air today, and you will receive a personal reply by mail. We want you to feel that this is your program. We welcome your criticism, your suggestions as to topics and speakers. The Foundation wishes to express its appreciation to the schools and colleges now using electrical transcriptions of the Wake Up America broadcast. All educational institutions not availing themselves of this opportunity are cordially invited to do so. Now here's Cliff Engel to tell you how to secure a copy of today's broadcast on the subject of next week's Wake Up America debate.
If you desire a printed copy of this broadcast, address your request with 10 cents in coin or stamps to Wake Up America, Carnegie Hall, Cleveland, Ohio. Next week at this same time, Wake Up America presents a debate entitled, Is Government Economic Planning Necessary for the Preservation of Democracy? The speakers will be Mr. George Soule, editor of the New Republic magazine, and Dr. Alfred P. Hockey, nationally known economist and lecturer. On this broadcast, telephone questions will be accepted from York, Pennsylvania. Remember, if you live in or around York, you will have an opportunity next Sunday to question the Wake Up America speakers. This is Cliff Engel thanking you and inviting you all to be with us again next week at the same time. If you live in or around New York City and would like to attend one of these broadcasts, address your request to the National Broadcasting Company, Radio City, New York. Wake Up America has been presented as a public service by NBC and the independent radio stations associated with the Blue Network of the National Broadcasting Company.